Okay, we're back, and we're now going to consider, let me backtrack, I guess, before we move ahead. In our last lecture, we talked about resultism as a theory of the right. And when we talk about theories of the right, we're talking about how to determine the difference between right and wrong. So theories of the right help us to make those distinctions. We began with resultism. And as I told you in the last lecture, resultism is the position that says that the goodness or badness of results are morally relevant to determining whether actions are right or wrong. So that's an important distinction that you'll have to keep in mind as we move forward, especially as we begin to encounter utilitarian thinking. So as we account for the results of our actions, one of the questions that will naturally arise is, which results count, and what results do I have to pay attention to? One position that could be taken up is to suggest that the only results I have to pay attention to are the results that affect me directly. Results that affect other people directly are irrelevant to whether actions are right or wrong. Now, that seems to, in some way, evade the moral life. Of course, if you're only paying attention to the results as they affect you, then actions that you perform that have poor results for me really wouldn't matter when you're trying to make certain calculations about how your actions will impact other human beings. And so it seems that the moral life will require us to pay attention to the results as they come about, not only for ourselves, but for others as well, right? I have to pay attention to the results for everyone, not just for me. If I'm committed to paying attention to the results as they come about for me only, we would call you an ethical egoist. Right? So the view called ethical egoism says that the moral thing to do is to look out for yourself. And for all intents and purposes, ethical egoism is really a moral non-starter. At least it seems to be. Because the moral life seems to imply a kind of universal application, right? Such that the moral life pulls us out of ourselves and implicitly requires that we care about the well-being of other human beings, right? Not only our own well-being. Now, as we move forward, we'll want to be careful because there are several different forms of egoism that we'll encounter across the semester. One particular view we'll contrast with ethical egoism is something called rational egoism. Rational egoism is actually a fairly defensible position. It's distinguished from ethical egoism in this way. Rational egoists say that the rational thing to do is for us to behave in our own self-interest, while ethical egoists claim that it's moral for us to behave in our own self-interest, right? And so the only reason, in other words, that I would help someone else, is if there's something in it for me. And for the ethical egoist, that means it's moral for me to only regard the results as they come about for me. Now, the difference, of course, is that for the rational egoist, it's rational to behave. And that isn't anything new, I've said that already. So just keep those distinctions in mind, and I think those positions will become far more clear as we move forward. Okay, so let's see. So it makes sense then for us to take interest or to pay attention to the results as they come about for everyone. But one of the things that we may wonder about is whether or not I have to pay attention to only the immediate results of my actions, or if I also have to pay attention to the future results of my actions. And of course, on an intuitive level, we understand that future results matter too. Right? In this sense, I might go to the dentist to avoid a small pain now, to undergo a small pain now in order to avoid greater pain in the future. In the same way, if I were to build a time bomb that will go off, in 10 years from now, and I put that time bomb in, a playground or something, and it goes off and it kills a family. I'm still responsible for those results, even though they are future results and not immediate results. So on an intuitive level, we recognize that future results matter too. All right. So everything I've said up to this point has to do with theories of the right. So our lecture last time, I introduced resultism. Resultism is a theory of the right. But there are, of course, other theories of the right that we could entertain, and ultimately we will entertain, but not at this time. I want to shift our attention away from our theory of the right, which for the time being will be resultism. But now I want to consider the good life, or in other words, what theory best accounts for the overall or general good? In other words, we could ask this question. What does the good life consist of? What does the good life have in it that a bad life doesn't? Okay. So we need a theory to distinguish between good results and bad results. I mean, that's one of the upshots. If you think back to our definition of resultism for just a moment, I said that resultism is the view that says the goodness or badness of results are morally relevant to determining whether actions are right or wrong. So, in a sense, we can't even use this definition, right, to determine our actions yet, because we don't have a way of distinguishing between good results and bad results. I think probably on an intuitive level, you would recognize what good results are, what bad results are, but there may be cases that arise in which we can't easily determine what truly is a good result and what truly is a bad result. So it will be important for us to develop, as I say, a theory of the good. So, what theory will best allow us to move forward in that way? Well, as I say, we want to think about the results for everyone, including future results. And one way to do this is to think about well-being, or even happiness, right? When I talk about well-being in our class, I'm talking about happiness. And when I talk about happiness, I'm talking about well-being. Now, if you were to look at, a philosophical journal, a contemporary philosophical journal, you would most likely see the term well-being rather than the term happiness. However, in your readings, when you read Mill, for example, he will talk about the principle of happiness rather than talking about well-being. But, utilitarians still use the language of happiness. However, the term happiness is a little ambiguous. They've shifted their attention to this concept of well-being. And well-being just means living well, right? What does it mean to live well? So, as I say, one way to think about the good is to talk about, or to think about, well-being. So, what is well-being? Well, again, here we just have to ask the question, what does the good life have in it that a bad life doesn't? Now, there are several approaches we could take. One of the most prominent, and of course, one of the views propounded by Mill and even other theorists like Sigmund Freud, is a view called hedonism. Now, hedonism is a theory of what it means to live well, right? A theory of what it means to have a good life. Unfortunately, hedonism has taken on negative connotations, such that when I call someone a hedonist, I usually mean something very negative. That is really not to use the term in a philosophical sense. For philosophers, when we talk about hedonism, we're just talking about living a life that is filled with more pleasure than pain. And so that's all that's meant by hedonism. Unfortunately, as I say, the term now means something like, if I call someone a hedonist, I'm thinking, well, they're only interested in pursuing, bodily pleasures like eating and having sex or whatever it might be. But hedonists, in a philosophical sense, are really interested in just maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. And so it's not a bad way to go, right? We think, what does the good life have in it? Well, it has more pleasure than pain. And of course, those pleasures will take a very wide-ranging sort of instantiation of you know, instances of pleasure, right? You wouldn't want to focus on one particular pleasure for your entire life. If your life only had sexual pleasure in it, your life would be pretty devoid and uninteresting. So you want to encourage, or it seems to me that hedonists would want to encourage a wide range of experiences that are all pleasurable. Right? Reading novels, and as you'll see in a few moments, the types of pleasures that we can experience are quite wide-ranging. All right, so let's see. Of course, for the hedonist, the only thing that matters is pleasure, right, and the absence of pain. Hedonists want to maximize instances of pleasure in our lives and in the lives of other human beings, right? And so when we combine hedonism with our account of what makes an action right, what we get is something like this, right? Right actions are those actions that promote pleasure, right? Not only pleasure for myself, but pleasure for other human beings as well, right? Okay, so first thing to remember, hedonists are going to make a distinction between things called instrumental goods and intrinsic goods, right? Such that some things are instrumentally valuable, while other things are intrinsically valuable. Ice cream, for example, leads to pleasure. If I eat ice cream, I have a pleasurable sensation on my palate, and that brings me pleasure, of course. But is ice cream intrinsically valuable, or is it only instrumentally valuable? Well, hedonists are going to claim that ice cream is only instrumentally valuable, okay? And the way to wrap your mind around this concept is to think about what it means for something to be instrumentally valuable, right? When I use the word instrumental, what I'm suggesting is that it's like a tool or device, right? I use it to bring about some other experience, in this case, the experience of pleasure, right? So I want to create a pleasurable sensation. What do I have to do in order to secure a pleasurable sensation? Well, I have to use something else, right? Some device or tool, like ice cream. So ice cream, in this case, is instrumentally valuable. What about aspirin? Why would I take aspirin? Well, I take aspirin. Maybe I have a headache, and I'm trying to avoid, you know, suffering through this headache. So I take aspirin in order to avoid the pain that, you know, I'm feeling. So aspirin, in this case, again, like ice cream, is instrumentally valuable. We wouldn't care about ice cream, we wouldn't care about aspirin, if it didn't bring about a more pleasurable sensation for us, right? So I take the aspirin in order to minimize or to reduce the pain that I'm experiencing. I eat ice cream in order to increase the pleasure that I'm experiencing, right? So these things are both instrumentally valuable. For hedonists, only one thing has intrinsic value, and that is pleasure, right? Only pleasure has intrinsic value. For something to be intrinsically valuable, it is, what do we say? It is valuable in itself, or valuable for its own sake. That is, it doesn't appeal to anything else for its value. Notice the difference between aspirin, or ice cream, and pleasure itself, right? The hedonist claims that pleasure itself is intrinsically valuable, while these other things, like aspirin and ice cream, are only instrumentally valuable. Right? So what's the difference? Well, pleasure doesn't appeal to anything else for its value, while aspirin or ice cream have to appeal to their ability to bring about pleasurable states, right? And so they're not intrinsically valuable, that is to say, they don't appeal to themselves for their value. They're only valuable insofar as they can bring about pleasurable states of affairs, right? And so that's the distinction that you'll have to keep in mind. Something that's intrinsically valuable is valuable all on its own. It doesn't have to appeal to anything else for its value. While instrumental goods are good only to the extent that they can bring about, in this case, a pleasurable sensation, right? Okay, so let's see. What about pain? We could think about pain for a moment. Pain, interestingly enough, can be instrumentally valuable, right? Think about a toothache. I have a slight toothache. It's slightly painful, but it motivates me to go to the dentist. Now, I go to the dentist so I can avoid a greater pain in the future. So in this case, you know, this slight pain in my tooth motivates me to avoid greater pain later. And what we want to say here is that pain, in this case, motivates me to avoid greater pain in the future. And as such, pain in this case is instrumentally valuable. Right? Okay. Let's see now. Okay, so let's think for a moment about how we might account for pleasurable experiences and how we might distinguish between experiences that are more intensely pleasurable, other experiences in which pleasures last for a long time, and how we might, how we might determine whether our lives are ultimately pleasurable, right? Now, Jeremy Bentham proposed that the way to do this is to multiply the intensity of a given experience by the duration of a given experience, right? Of that same given experience, and that will tell us just how pleasurable that given experience is, right? So that if I want to understand the intensity of experience, I have to think about quantifying my experience, right? Quantifying my pleasurable experiences. So, some pleasures are far more intense than others, right? Chewing on a Starburst is it's an intense experience, I suppose, but it's far less intense than having sex with your favorite movie star, right? So, sexual activity is a very intense experience, or can be. While chewing a Starburst is intense, it's not as intense as having sexual relations with, you know, whoever it might be. We can rank these experiences in terms of their intensity, and we can do the same for duration. Some experiences last longer than others. For example, reading a Harry Potter novel, that experience can last over, you know, in some cases, I've heard of one kid reading the last volume 7 of Harry Potter in 16 or 17 hours, which is quite remarkable. So, you know, that experience for this child lasted for 16 or 17 hours. It's a long time, longer than chewing a stick of gum, right? So if I wanted to rank in terms of duration how long a given pleasurable experience would last, chewing a stick of gum is far, you know, doesn't last quite as long as reading a novel, but we derive pleasure from both experiences. Okay, so one way to account for variations in experience is to multiply the intensity of a given experience by the duration of that experience, and that will yield some product, right? It will tell me whether or not, it will yield some product that will determine just how pleasurable a given experience is, right? Okay, I could also do the same for my painful experiences, right? I could measure the intensity of my painful experiences, right? And I could make certain rankings. I could say, well, look, last night I stubbed my toe on the way to the bathroom in the dark, and, you know, it hurt like hell, and it was fairly intense. But a few years ago I got into a car accident, I broke my leg, and that was far more intense than stubbing my toe. So in terms of ranking these experiences, in terms of intensity, breaking your leg in a car accident is far more intense than stubbing your toe on the way to the bathroom. And I could do the same for duration, right? The healing process, so as my leg, heals after the car accident, right, it takes several months perhaps to recover from a car accident, whereas recovering from a stubbed toe is a relatively short experience, and I could rank those in terms of duration. The point here, of course, is that I can multiply the intensity of a given experience, a given painful experience in this case, by the intensity of a painful, or sorry, by the duration of a painful experience, and then that would also yield some product. So what I'd want to do in that case is take those two products, right, all of the pleasure I have experienced in my life, and I subtract all of the painful experiences I've had in my life from the pleasure, and that will yield the difference, right? And if we have some kind of positive indication, that is to say, if my life on the whole has been more pleasurable than painful, what we want to say is that I've lived a good life, right? Subtracting all of the painful experiences I've had from the pleasurable experiences I've had. Okay, so this is Mill's suggestion, but Bentham's suggestion. Now, you haven't read anything by Bentham. Bentham, his name is Jeremy Bentham, and he was Mill's mentor. So you have read some of John Stuart Mill by this time, and he studied under Jeremy Bentham. Both of these theorists are utilitarians, but they differ on the nature of hedonism, right? Bentham is a quantitative hedonist. Mill later developed something called qualitative hedonism. And that difference will become clear to you in the next few minutes. Okay, so let's see. Alright, so one of the things we should be able to do is multiply the intensity of a pleasure times the duration of a pleasure, with yielding some product, and then multiply the intensity of all the painful experiences I've had by the duration of all the experiences I've had. That will also yield some product, and I subtract the pain in my life from the pleasure in my life, and that will yield the difference. And if the difference is positive, that tells me that I've lived a good life as opposed to a bad life. If the number is negative, then I've lived a bad life. Okay, so Mill very early on recognized that there were going to be problems with quantitative hedonism. Right? What we can determine is that if we can only measure our experiences in terms of quantity, what that will essentially mean is that all of our experiences will ultimately be the same unit for unit. Now, it's important to focus on what I'm saying here. When I talk about experiences being the same unit for unit, I want you to focus on unit for unit, right? So that if I broke my experiences down in terms of quantity, that is, I'm giving sort of an arbitrary value to each of my experiences, right? So eating a bowl of ice cream, we'll say that that's worth 3 units of pleasure, right? Having sex with Nicole Kidman, for me, you know, that's like 100 units of pleasure. Or maybe even more, 200 units of pleasure. That was a joke, by the way. Anyway, let's see. So you get the picture of how we can rank our experiences. A bowl of ice cream is only worth 3 units of pleasure, but having sex with your favorite movie star, you know, that's worth a lot more pleasure. You know, maybe 100, 150, or 200 units of pleasure, right? So what Bentham is implicitly suggesting, right, and I think ultimately he probably overlooked the importance of this point, and of course Mill later points out why quantitative hedonism may not work, is because it reduces all experiences to units, right? And unit for unit, all of our experiences will be the same. The only way to mark differences in experiences is to think of them in terms of quantity, right? So ultimately, you know, if I wanted to know what it's like to have sex with Nicole Kidman, all I'd have to do is eat lots and lots of bowls of ice cream. But of course, that doesn't make any sense. I can't know what it's like to have sex with Nicole Kidman by eating ice cream, right? But that's the upshot of Bentham's position, right? Such that unit for unit, all experiences are the same. So when I add up units of pleasure, all I need to do is have more and more pleasure, and that would ultimately tell me what it's like to, you know, to have sex with Nicole Kidman, as I've said. So this is a problem, obviously, and it's a problem that Mill was well aware of. Now, one of the things that that you'll want to pay attention to is just how Mill makes us aware of this distinction. And if you turn in your reading the book, Utilitarianism, you can read a passage where Mill makes the distinction between quantitative and qualitative hedonism. Now, of course, he doesn't use that language. The language is relatively recent, more recent than Mill's writings. So I'm turning, in my book, it's on page 9 and 10, but of course, your version of the book is online, and all I can tell you is that it's in chapter 2, pretty close to the front. Okay, so Mill has this to say, right? He says, few human creatures would consent to be changed into any of the lower animals for a promise of the fullest allowance of a beast's pleasures. No intelligent human being would consent to be a fool. No instructed person would be an ignoramus. No person of feeling and conscience would be selfish and base, even though they should be persuaded that the fool, the dunce, or the rascal is better satisfied with his lot than they are with theirs. Now, turning the page, slightly down, let's see, one more paragraph down, I guess. Mill continues, "It is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. And if the fool or the pig are of a different opinion, it is because they only know their own side of the question. The other party to the comparison knows both sides." Okay, so this is Mill thinking about what we've just been talking about, right? Thinking about quantitative hedonism. Thinking about the quandary that Jeremy Bentham has got us into, right? If the only way we have of accounting for the differences in experience, right, is quantity, right? Meaning that, the difference between, skydiving and eating lunch is that skydiving is intensely pleasurable and it lasts for a relatively short period of time, but intensely pleasurable, right? Lunch can last perhaps even longer than skydiving, right? Depending on how high up you are. So if I wanted to compare those two experiences, eating lunch and skydiving, how would I do it? Well, I'd have to multiply the intensity times the duration of that experience, and I'd have to do the same for having lunch, right? And then I would compare them. Which one has more units of pleasure? And that's the only way I could compare them. Mill's point is that these experiences are nothing alike. Eating lunch is nothing like skydiving. They're qualitatively distinct. Right? This is why Mill's position is called qualitative hedonism. What Mill wants to track is the quality of a given experience, not the quantity of a given experience. Right? In other words, Mill wants to be able to distinguish between kinds of experience or types of experience. Okay? Now, with quantitative hedonism, we can't do that because, as I've said, unit for unit, all experiences are ultimately the same. Now, think back to what I just read from Mill's book. Right? Mill says that it's better to be a pig, sorry, not better to be a pig, that it's better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. What is he saying here? Well, ultimately, he seems to be saying something like this. None of us would trade our lives for the life of a pig, even though we might be convinced that the pig, in terms of quantity, has more pleasure in its life than we do in ours, right? I mean, think of what the pig's life is like. The pig wallows in the mud, eats slop, lives a life of almost complete bodily pleasure. His relationships with other pigs are not very complex. And we might be convinced that the pig's life is far better than our own. But none of us would trade our lives for the life of the pig. And the reason seems to be this, that we're not convinced that the pig actually does have a better life, but the reason isn't because of the quantity of pleasure, the reason is because the pig does not experience high quality pleasures. So now Mill is making a distinction between lower quality pleasures and higher quality pleasures. And this is to move beyond Bentham, right? When Bentham suggested that the only way to track the differences in experience is to think about quantity, Mill says, well, that can't be right. We need a way of tracking the quality of a given experience, not simply the quantity of a given experience. So none of us will trade our life for the life of a pig, because ultimately the pig has low quality pleasures. Human beings, on the other hand, are capable of high quality pleasures, right? Human relationships are fairly complex, and we do draw a great amount of satisfaction from entering into relationships, loving relationships, familial, whatnot. Human beings can read novels, human beings can go to the movies, human beings can drive nice cars. Pigs can't have any of these experiences, and ultimately pigs can't experience higher quality pleasures while human beings can. And Mill wants to suggest that that's the reason, ultimately, that we wouldn't trade our life for the life of a pig. So, what does this mean? Well, at the very least, it means that Bentham's view, quantitative hedonism, is inadequate. Right? Not wrong, simply inadequate, right? It doesn't allow us to account for the quality of pleasures. Or in other words, it doesn't allow us to make distinctions in kind. It only allows us to track quantities of pleasure, which ultimately will mean that the only way to draw distinctions between experiences is to track the amount of pleasure it has. And the problem with that is that it makes all experiences ultimately the same, unit for unit. Okay, so where does that bring us? I hope you understand. Now, if you do have questions as we move through this material, it will be important for you to at least email me or contact me in some way. You can come to my office hours if you're close enough to campus. If not, then email me or call me. Make sure you do it, of course, during my office hours, and I can give you enough time, and give you enough time to ask all of the questions you might have. So if you feel like you're confused or lost, then I would suggest that you call me during my office hours, or send an email, and I'll try to answer your questions that way. Okay, so let's see. Where does that bring us? Well, let's think about just exactly what Mill is suggesting. Mill thinks the only way to get people to enjoy higher quality experiences is to educate them. In fact, he wrote a book called The Subjugation of Women, wherein he argued that it was very important for women to be exposed to education. And after Mill, you have a rise in women's education, and you also have the development of public education, making education accessible to even the very poor. Before Mill, that was almost unheard of. In fact, for all intents and purposes, it was unheard of. Women had a very hard time getting into universities, so Mill is really the first theorist to suggest that women really also need to go to school, not just men. And the reason for this, of course, is that he thinks education is integral to helping human beings enjoy the highest quality experiences possible for human beings, right? If people are uneducated, generally speaking, they will be unable to enjoy higher quality experiences. Right? In other words, we'll be like animals, like pigs. We won't have the necessary tools in order to enjoy higher quality experiences. Right? Now, of course, this is a problem because it leads to a form of elitism, or you might suggest that it leads to a form of elitism, wherein, uneducated people really don't have a lot to say about what higher quality experiences happen to be. So this is a problem. I mean, imagine Frank the Mechanic. Now, I don't know anyone named Frank the Mechanic. I don't know anyone named Frank that happens to be a mechanic. This is just a figment of my imagination. But let's talk about Frank the Mechanic, who, has never really been exposed to formal education. What does he enjoy? Well, he enjoys being under the hood of a car. And in that sense, he knows a lot about fixing cars and mechanical problems and whatnot. But he really doesn't enjoy reading. He's never read a book on his own. So he spends all his time reading Playboy magazine or, you know, whatever, and likes to visit strip clubs or whatever it might be, right? So how do we get Frank out of that life? And you might even say that Frank has a drug problem. You could say, you know, that Frank occasionally uses crack cocaine or something like that. How do we get Frank out of that sort of mindset? Well, Mill's suggestion, of course, is that we send him to school. Educate him such that he will learn to enjoy higher quality experiences. And of course, as I've suggested, this suggests a form of elitism, such that Frank, without education, or anyone without education, will be unable to experience higher quality pleasures. What this suggests is ultimately a way, what it points to is what we need to do is develop a way of distinguishing between higher and lower quality pleasures, right? And if we're going to suggest that without education, Frank is unable or less equipped to recognize the difference between higher quality pleasures and lower quality pleasures, what we need to do is to develop a way of understanding how to compare experiences. And in the passage that I read to you earlier, Mill does actually suggest one way to do that, right? He says that it's better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates, right, an enlightened individual, dissatisfied than a fool, an unenlightened individual that is satisfied, right? And then he says this, and if the fool or the pig are of a different opinion, it is because they only know their own side of the question. The other party to the comparison knows both sides, right? So what Mill is ultimately suggesting is that in order to recognize the distinction between higher quality pleasures and lower quality pleasures, we need a way of comparing them. The only way we can compare them sufficiently is for us to have been exposed to both experiences. So imagine this case. If I want to compare reading Bertrand Russell's History of Philosophy with listening to Britney Spears, what would I have to do? Well, I'd have to expose myself to Bertrand Russell's History of Philosophy. I'd have to read it through and sort of understand it and enjoy it, right? And then I'd have to also listen to Britney Spears, right? And not listen to her just one time, I'd have to listen to her music and sort of absorb it. And, you know, read about her in magazines and sort of learn about Britney Spears and have that sort of contrast. And then I could sort of determine which is the better experience, right? Now, so if I want to know which is a higher quality experience, reading Bertrand Russell or listening to Britney Spears, I'd have to have the experiences. But it wouldn't be enough, right? So it wouldn't be enough just to do that. You don't want to only find one person who's had those experiences. You want to get a consensus, right? So if I only rely on my own experiences, it's possible for me to sort of develop some kind of idiosyncratic conception of which is a higher quality pleasure and which isn't. What I'd want to do is find a sample of individuals who have read Bertrand Russell's History of Philosophy and who also enjoy listening to Britney Spears, right? In which case, I'd have something like this. 86% of people who both have read Bertrand Russell's History of Philosophy and who enjoy listening to Britney Spears agree that reading Bertrand Russell is a higher quality pleasure, right? And so that's the sort of thing that we'd want to move toward, right? Getting a sample size large enough so that we can make some fairly strong claims about, you know, which is a higher quality pleasure and which isn't, right? And that's, of course, Mill's suggestion, and ultimately he thinks that's about as good as we're going to get, right? Because, after all, there is some subjectivity, but we want to eliminate as much subjectivity here as we possibly can. All right. So I think we've covered enough in this lecture for now, and we'll come back. We'll start from here the next time we come together.